Welcome to another edition of Inside Maine. This is Angus King, and we talk about issues on this program and podcast going on in Maine, but also in the country as they affect the state of Maine. Today, we're talking about one of the really promising and important programs Congress has passed, I think, in the last 25 or 30 years, and that is massive support for the expansion of broadband across the country, but particularly in rural areas, and particularly in Maine. Our first guest today is Andrew Butcher, who's the head of the Maine Connectivity Authority, which is a jointly funded project from between the state and the federal government. And their job is to oversee the expenditure of the amount of money that's been coming from Washington and also some from Maine for wiring up the state. In 1936, the Congress, under the leadership of Franklin D. Roosevelt, passed the Rural Electrification Act. That basically led to the spread of electricity throughout the nation. At that time, it was only available in urban areas. Rural America was mostly dark. Now, we're going on a very similar mission to be sure that everyone in America is connected. And that's what this program is about, and that's what Andrew's been working on. Andrew, let's start with a sort of update. Where are we in terms of connecting everybody in Maine?
Senator, thanks for having me. Thanks for all the work that you've done in ensuring that we're able to meet the moment in addressing a rising demand for better internet. And honestly, it's wonderful to be back with you. As you may recall, my first month on the job 2.5 years ago, you were kind enough to invite me to join and talk about the plan ahead of us. And it has been quite a ride and certainly a huge amount of progress in that time. As you may recall, the Connectivity Authority was only established in 2022 as a quasi-governmental entity responsible for planning, developing, investing in, and maintaining our broadband infrastructure as a part of the overall connectivity needs in the state. And as the first employee, it was my honor to get started putting money to work and build a great team to be able to sustain the impact of the investment. And I'm pleased to report that over the course of the last 2 years, Maine's invested more than $150 million in broadband and high-speed internet. It's attracted nearly $81 million in matching investment, resulting in about 80,000 locations now having access to high-speed internet that didn't have it before. As of May of this year, less than approximately 1% of locations in Maine have no internet service option at all, which is significant when we think about addressing the connectivity compact of 2024, which we've been working under, and happy to speak more towards that.
Let me interrupt you. So is it accurate to say that 99% of Maine is wired and are connected in one way or another?
It's accurate to say that 99% of Maine has some form of service or technology option. That's not to say that amount has access to high-speed internet or is technically wired. As you know, those definitions get nerdy awfully quickly, and it can matter when upload speeds matter for you. What's really important is that we are now operating in an environment, given the resources that we've been able to deploy, blending state and federal over the last couple of years, to bring us really to a place where about 95, 96% of the state is effectively in a state of some form of modern broadband connection, really prioritizing the 4% of unserved locations that are eligible for federal funding, and that 1% representing folks with really no service, no option of any kind. So that the problem has been getting smaller, and we've been able to blend resources to be able to achieve that.
Well, let me back up a minute about why this is so important. And it was ironic that all of this was being considered, the pandemic came along. And we learned several things from the pandemic. One was the importance for seniors in particular, but lots of people, for the availability of telehealth, being able to visit the doctor's office without having to drive an hour. So connectivity made that possible. The second piece was kids being able to connect to their schools and do their homework. And the pandemic taught us how important those connections could be and would be going forward. And then the third piece, which I'm particularly excited about, is the creation of the opportunity for remote work all over the country. You can now live in Dover Foxcroft and work in Seattle. And that, I think, is a huge opportunity for rural Maine, where people who want a really wonderful lifestyle but also access to a good job can have both. even though they're living in a small town, not in Portland or Bangor or Presque Isle. And that's why I think it's important to remember why we're doing it. It's not just for fun or because it sounds right, but I think it's an enormous opportunity for a rural state like Maine.
It's an enormous opportunity and it's an enormous challenge. And the way we often think about it is our demand on the use of the internet is only increasing. And if you don't have the ability to access it, you're structurally limited in how you're able to participate, not just in the economy, but increasingly in civic affairs. As you know, the best way to get your fishing license in Maine is online. And the state has made that an easy and possible option. But if you can't access an internet service to be able to do that, then you can't participate in some of Maine's outdoor economy. But what it does, and I believe you coined the phrase, high-speed internet allows us to live where we love.
Yeah, we can work where we live instead of having to live where we work. And that's a historic change. I don't think we really realize the implications of that. For example, I was at L.L. Bean recently. They no longer have central call centers. All of their people that answer the phone when you call in are at home, somewhere in Maine. So it's enabled people who don't live near Freeport or Portland to be employees of one of Maine's premier companies. And they find that it's very successful. It works for them. The employees like it. That's a big change. It used to be you had to drive into a building. I remember going to an L.L. Bean call center in Portland. And now all those people are working from home.
When you say that, it really makes me think about just how rapidly things are changing and have been changing over the last couple of years. When we were working toward a state bond for broadband funding in 2020, early in the pandemic, looking for $20 million of state bond funding to invest in broadband infrastructure to address at the time what was thought was a $600 million problem, there was still a conversation around helping people understand why we need it and why it's important. Over the course of just 1 year, the shift turned into not only do we need it yesterday. And so when we think about the changes to the landscape, this is really one of the most exciting things about this work is that this is about thinking about how we will operate as a place in the future. And that has a huge amount of implications when we think about how we go about the planning, how we go about trying to maximize the impact of the funding. And frankly, I want to take the opportunity early to give you proper credit in recognizing the role of states in being able to deploy both the American Rescue Plan broadband funding as well as the bipartisan infrastructure law funding.
I don't want to get too much into the legislative weeds, but there was a huge, I don't want to call it a fight, but a lot of argument back and forth about who would administer the broadband funds. And the choice was between the FCC, which is a regulatory agency, or the Department of Commerce. And my position always was, along with Mark Warner of Virginia, was my sort of wingman on this, or I was his wingman, I don't know what. But anyway, our position was the states know best. The FCC shouldn't be deciding how states should administer this. Let's set up a program that basically gets the money to the states, and then the states know where the gaps are, where the need is. And that's for that view ultimately prevailed. So that's where the Maine Connectivity Authority came in. But that was an important internal debate. I understand it's sort of in the weeds, but I'm really glad it came out the way it did because I think it's worked.
I think it's been really critical, especially for a place like Maine, where, you know, thanks to your leadership over time and certainly many others in recognizing how important upgrading our infrastructure is. I think what it has allowed for us to do, and frankly, in national circles, they talk about it as the Maine way.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the best things is we've got this great community practice of other state broadband offices who share information and best practices. And, you know, the work that Maine has done is important in driving how we apply the policy, how we bring the funding together, and how we bring the public and private partnerships together.
Wasn't Maine the first state in the country to have an approved digital equity plan?
We were, with the Digital Equity Act and the provision to create a dedicated pool of funds in addition to the primary infrastructure funds. We bundled our digital equity planning with our broadband infrastructure planning so that really the idea of inclusion and people orientation first was driving the infrastructure. And I think that's been key to success in thinking about, you know, how we build on an approach where there were no resources to now an approach where there are more resources, and we still have a challenging place. You know, as you know, Maine has the highest concentration of rural population in the country. We have the highest concentration of older people in the country, and that has a huge impact in how we think about sustainable investments. So that, you know, being first in the digital equity was important. Also, I believe we were one of the first five or six in the country to be able to deploy funding through the capital projects funds in the American Rescue Plan. And so, you know, I'm really pleased to say that over the last 2 years, we have designed, developed, and deployed funding in seven different programs of $150 million for a range of uses utilizing the capital projects funds. You know, there are some states that are still figuring out how they're going to use those funds. So it has allowed for us to put the money to work quickly.
So you're working with internet providers, with communities, with various entities in order to assist in the capital costs, the wires, the poles, the pole charges, and all of that. That's your principal mission at this point.
That's certainly a big part of it. That set of work around in digital infrastructure and facilitating public-private partnerships that have a strong community and regional engagement capability. Our work is to help facilitate those partnerships, deploy the funding, and help administer in such a way that we're creating efficiencies where possible, ensuring that the work is happening in the highest quality way possible, and working with both internet service providers and public agencies and communities in tweaking, because there is no project where everything is clean and simple. But so far, over the last 3 years, we've effectively put together programming where we are managing over 70 different active infrastructure projects around the state.
Now, you've used the term digital equity several times. What we're really talking about here is affordability, right? It doesn't do anybody any good if they've got fiber going by their house, but they can't afford the service. So let's talk about affordability and how that's part of the project. Now, as I recall, one of the things we required in the bill, in the infrastructure bill, was that if private entities, internet service providers, cable companies, were using the federal money, they also had to offer an affordable option. Is that still working? Let's talk about affordability.
Yeah, happy to. Great point. You know, oftentimes there's sort of three fundamental planks to this work of enabling access, ensuring affordable service options, and helping support adoption, right? So the sort of three A's of digital equity and inclusion: access, affordability, and adoption. Access is the important one, because if there is no option, no access, then no one has inclusion, and that is no good. And the affordability is really critical. And so certainly requiring a low cost and or a middle income cost has been a key attribute of some of the infrastructure programming. All of the capital projects funding had a requirement of a low cost service and tracking on par with the affordable connectivity program prices. As you know, the affordable connectivity program was a federal subsidy to provide qualified households with a monthly subsidy. That's important when we think about building a base of the market economy to be able to sustain the use of the infrastructure. And certainly requiring a low-cost option, utilizing subsidy where possible is key to affordability, and ensuring that there's a diversity of services for consumers to be able to utilize, I think, has been a key point that you've built into much of your policy approach and some of the programs as well.
Well, the best way to regulate prices in my book is competition. That's one of the themes I know that you've worked on, so that people do have choices, and that in turn will help to keep prices in check.
And this is where I think so much of the Maine model comes into effect, because choice is a function of where there is a concentrated market and aggregating that market demand. This is where, you know, this is really how I got into this work, in that this is a community development challenge where there are equipped and engaged and informed citizens and partnerships or networks of partnerships. They drive demand, and that demand is the key to ensuring a public-private collaboration such that there is the ability to leverage private capital and maximize public capital. And so I think that drives demand, and that demand is what allows for a diversity of service options so that we're not just having to choose between option A or option B or technology one or technology two.
Well, there were some movements at the beginning 2 or 3 years ago of local communities getting together to create something like a utilities district to have 4 or 5 towns. I know up in Washington County that was really started, Danny Sullivan and others. Has that spread? Is that happening in other parts of the state?
So the quick context, the broadband utility districts is one form of a publicly owned or a community owned infrastructure model. And in Maine, we have a special designation of a utility district that allows for sort of distinct financing opportunities. And certainly the Down East Broadband Utility, I think as Maine sort of only operational broadband utility district, has done incredible work in paving that way. We have not seen a proliferation of utility districts and get a variety of mixed feedback as to whether it's the right fit in different places, in part because of the lack of density and also the challenges in being able to provide some of the necessary upfront capital. You know, receiving federal funds is one that requires a pretty high level of capacity on the receiving end of it. And when we talk about sort of small, locally owned networks, now there are probably 14 other community-owned broadband projects that a town or a municipality has embarked upon. And those represent really strong partnerships and certainly is a great model in approaching how to address connectivity needs.
Well, it's been an amazing project. And can I brag when I get back to Washington and say we're closing in on 95% connectivity in the most rural state in the country? This is something that's happened relatively fast. And, you know, people tease me, you know, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. But this is a place where the government really has helped.
It's funny. I had this exact conversation with my 9-year-old son at dinner last night as he suddenly shared a skepticism of government with me. And we had a strong conversation around the merits of public-private partnership. I didn't quite win that one, but I think that to your point, we have a huge opportunity to be able to share what we've been doing. You know, when you look at Maine's work we were one of the only 13 states to receive a precursor to BEAD funding in 2021. We were the first state to produce our digital equity plan. We were the 11th state to get an approved volume 1 and volume 2 of our BEAD program. We've deployed almost all of our capital projects funds. We were a recipient of the competitive middle mile funds. We're rolling out a publicly owned and operated middle mile infrastructure to ensure that we are sustaining the impact of and ensuring long-term public benefit to our broadband infrastructure through the Maine Open Optical Statewide Enabling Network, or MooseNet.
I love it. MooseNet. It had to be MooseNet. I mean, you guys have been very creative. Well, listen, we're going to talk in a couple of minutes with Joe Manchin, who represents a state that's not unlike Maine in terms of its rural nature, with a couple of urban areas. And Joe was one of the key people that we worked with on putting this all together. But Andrew, one of my mottos is execution is as important as vision. And you've proven that in such a dramatic way that the way this has been executed and implemented is amazing. And keep it up. Let me know when I can say 100% of Maine is connected. That's when I want to take to the floor down at the Senate.
Well, we absolutely will. And Senator, thanks for all of your past, present, and ongoing leadership on the issue.
Well, we're going to keep at it. It's the very first thing that I wrote an essay about when I was running for the Senate the first time. I quoted Lincoln about how infrastructure was really the basis of economic development. And he was talking about roads and highways. And now we're talking about broadband. And we want to be sure that our broadband is not a rutted country road, but a high-speed highway. And that's what you're doing. So, Andrew, thank you very much. Keep in touch. Let us know what we need if there are problems in the law or prodding of the agencies in Washington, you know that we'll be here I'll be here and others will be here to help.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate all of your and your team's availability. The access and collaboration has been outstanding. So thank you.
Well, you're right to just talk about the team. I've got absolutely wonderful people. Adam Lachman, as you know, has really been a key guy in this, both in the development of the legislation, but also in the implementation. And I've got good people. My motto, Andrew, is hire good people and take credit for what they do. And it's worked.
Noted. Right. Well, keep up the good work then.
All right. Thanks, man. We'll be in touch.
Bye-bye. All right. Thank you. Bye now.
And stay tuned on Inside Maine for more talk about broadband from a national perspective with my friend Joe Manchin, U.S. Senator from West Virginia. We'll be back in a minute on Inside Maine. Stay with us. Welcome back to Inside Maine. This is Angus King. We're talking today about broadband, about high-speed internet, how important it is for the 21st century, how especially important it is for a rural state like Maine. And my next guest is a guy that knows about rural states. He knows about broadband. He knows a lot about this issue. It's Joe Manchin, Senator from West Virginia, independent senator from West Virginia. Welcome to the club, Joe.
Welcome to the club. I'm happy to be in the club, I can tell you.
All right, man. Well, tell me about the situation in West Virginia, say, 10 years ago with regard to access to broadband.
Well, let me go back when I first came in, right, about the same time, a little bit before you, but we came into the Senate. And they were telling me, and I had I was on Commerce at one time, and I took the chairman of the Commerce Committee, chairman of the FCC, and I said, you know what, your maps are all wrong. I don't have the coverage you're telling me I have, and I look at your maps, and I says, who did the testing? Well, those are given to us by the providers. So I said, so a provider's telling you they're covering so that they can basically keep that market area that no one else is intruding on. Well, I can tell you it's not true. So I had him, Tom, the chairman at that time, I said, meet me up in Pocahontas County, meet me up there, or we'll go over to another mountain county. So we went up there and I said, we're going to meet at a career school. He said, fine. So we got there and I said, why don't you call back your office right now on your cell phone? And use anybody's cell phone. I really don't care who you use because you say we got good coverage here. Your map shows we got good coverage. Just call back and see if they have any messages for you. He tried three carriers that some of his people had, different phones, couldn't get anything. I said, Tom, there's something wrong with the maps. So we start fighting the maps. That was our first. And then we start doing self-testing, Angus, all over my state. I started telling the citizens how to do on their own cell phone, how to test, to find out if they have coverage on, were they meeting the minimum standards? And they weren't. So we were able to get the maps changed. By getting the maps changed, we were awarded $1.2 billion. $1.2 billion. Because our state is so mountainous and so hard. We have no flat land, Larry. You know, no, not much different probably than yours.
Is it true that people in West Virginia generally have one leg longer than the other?
If they live there long enough, they do.
Well,
the cows definitely do anyway.
So you had you have the terrain that made it really hard to connect. And I agree with you about the maps. In fact, one of the arguments you'll remember when we were doing the bipartisan infrastructure bill was who was going to hand out the money, and a bunch of us fought for it being Department of Commerce because we were afraid that the FCC was still going to use those old maps. And we weren't going to get the money where it needed to go.
Well, we fought that pretty hard in Commerce Committee when I was there at that time. And they were right. They were damn determined to put the money out on the old maps. And we stopped them. We were able to because we were able to file with the test that we've done to prove their maps were inaccurate. And went from West Virginia, which knocked down the whole system. I kept going back to, I said, let me tell you something. Rural electrification, and I think it was the 1936 Rural Electrification Act under FDR. How were we able to get a wire to everybody's home to give them some form of energy, reliable energy, electricity? We did that. But you know how we did it? they couldn't force the utility, the big guys. So they built co-ops. And I said, why can't we work through co-ops again? The co-ops don't have profit minded. They don't have shareholders. They don't have any of that except service. And that's what we've tried to gear everything towards. I've got one of the better, I think one of the better co-ops in the country. It's in Hardy County. It's called, it's Hardy Tail. They call it, it's Hardy Tail, we call it. And they have done unbelievable. And they just, they're just really going gangbusters in the most rural areas of my state.
Well, we've got cases in Maine where small towns have gotten together to create like a utility district. Yeah. Be able to do this. And the build out is really happening. I mean, are you, I was just now talking to our connectivity guy who's in charge of this in Maine. He said, we're close to 95% people access to broadband right now. And, well, and that's amazing compared with where we were just a few years ago.
Well, I saw also where you all received $272 million. From the same program, the FCC broadband maps, off the maps. Your state of Maine got 272 because your maps were inaccurate.
Yep. And we're headed now toward about 400, which they tell me is enough to pretty much ensure the wiring of the whole state. Are they making good progress in West Virginia?
My biggest thing is that we still have challenged areas, but ours is the terrain is so challenging. In our mountainous areas, my whole state, I don't have any flat land in the whole state. So with that being said, we're doing some with broadband towers and things of that sort. Well, how you're using the money, what you're able to do. So we have done what we call extreme terrain. If you have a state where you have extreme terrain, then you should be allotted to be able to use that money in those areas that have much more higher cost of putting towers up and being able to get to people's homes in rural areas.
Do you have a state agency that's running this program in West Virginia?
We do have a state agency that's been doing that and everything, but basically we have a lot of the locals, but you know, we just didn't go with the big guys. Frontier had most of our state at one time. The T-Mobile and all them have moved in pretty heavily. Then we have some local, and these co-ops have done a great job really basically taking it on themselves and working with a better provider that they had better rapport with and could work with them a lot easier. So we've given a lot of flexibility there. Our main goal was, how do we get people connected? When you think about just having electricity in 1936, this is as important as having the basic necessity of electricity for your quality of life that you may have had to be able to compete in a 21st century global economy. You just can't do it unless you're connected.
Well, I can even go back further than 36.
Uh-oh.
Or not, Abraham Lincoln's first brochure, when he ran for the Illinois legislature at the age of 23 and lost, was all about infrastructure. He was talking about roads and waterways, but the principle's exactly the same. And as you say, 36 really brought electricity to rural America, and we're talking about the same thing. And the advantages are just tremendous. We're already finding people in Maine who are able to work all over the country and live where they want to live.
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot too. Well, we saw, you know, the pandemic came through it. People, we call it QTL. Have you ever heard the phrase QTL?
No.
Quality of time left. People had a chance to stay home and realize, what's my life? What's it like? What could it be like? So what quality of time do I have left? It might be 40, it might be 60, it might be 80. What time do I have left? I want to enjoy it a little bit. Our parks are filled up. We couldn't, I mean, the visitors coming to West Virginia, and I'm sure to Maine at the same time. And once they got there, says, if I could just stay here and make a living, I'm going to stay right here.
Well, we've had a lot of people since the pandemic moved to Maine. A lot of them were buying houses sight unseen.
The
downside is it's driven the house prices up, but we have new people moving in. But the other thing that I've been really focused on is the opportunity this presents for a small town that used to rely on some kind of industrial base. It's an opportunity for new jobs. And as I said to somebody the other day, you can now live where you work. You can now work where you live instead of having to live where you work.
Well, just think how much of education attainment we fell behind in that 2 years, year and a half that we were sequestered in, especially if you didn't have connectivity. In rural areas, a lot of the parents would drive their children to the front of a connectivity area, like a school or a post office or something of a federal that had Wi-Fi, and they would tap into that. That's how they were getting their homework done. That's awful. And we have lost, I mean, a tremendous generation of a year of education. They just didn't receive because they didn't have the connectivity. On top of that, I had a lot of veterans calling me and says, Senator, you got to help me. And then I had doctors calling me. They says, we telehealth, how are we going to have telehealth? We have no connectivity.
Right.
So then the doctors were upset because they weren't getting reimbursed, Angus. And they said, can't you reimburse us if we spend the same amount of time on a telephone? If they can't see me, at least maybe I can explain to them.
And we got that done, Joe.
Yes,
and
we did.
We got to keep it in place so they don't backtrack on that.
I know. But I'll tell you, the Emergency Connectivity Fund authorized the American Rescue Plan. That was $7.17 billion to expand distant learning and connectivity across the country. We have put enough money. If people will just basically hold people accountable, companies accountable, help the co-ops to give you more bang for your buck, I think, than anything else. And the towns are cohesing together, and by God, support it, Angus. That's all I can say.
Well, the thing I like about part of the infrastructure bill was it was required that if you took federal money to build out your system, you had to provide an alternative that was affordable. Because if you have the wire go by your house, but you can't afford it, that's still a lack of connectivity.
Well, you know, we talked about the maps when we first started out. Do you know in 2015 in our committee, the FCC reported that 99.9% of Americans had wireless coverage.
They reported that.
That's what started the fiasco with the maps. That's what got me fired up and started it. So that's how it began. And I says, you're going to sit here. And the chairman at that time, chairman of FCC, says, we have our maps are showing. That's when we found out they weren't their maps. They were the maps that the providers were giving them.
Providers.
The big guys. The guys are basically making the money off of it.
Now, what are you doing in West Virginia with the terrain? Do you have not only fiber wire, but also wireless?
We have wireless too. Yeah, in some areas we have to because we just can't get to them. But we have to make sure they have certain speeds and everything in order to qualify for that. And if you can't show us that your technology will give us the speeds, then we're not going to do it. So we're using a combination of both.
Yeah, that's essentially what we're doing in Maine. Although we'll tell you, we're doing a lot of fiber. Everywhere you drive in Maine the last couple of years, you see trucks, bucket trucks, working on the wires. And you mentioned telehealth. That's the other thing we found during the pandemic was seniors using telehealth. Seniors and veterans, and the providers liked it because people made their appointments more frequently, and the patients liked it because they didn't have to drive an hour or two and sit in a doctor's office. They could get their appointment in and out, and it proved to be really effective. And I hope we can keep the regulations in place so that the federal government doesn't backtrack on the availability of telehealth.
Well, I can't believe that they would, because now that we've gotten more connectivity and faster speeds, Angus, we should be in much, much better shape on that. I just think that, you know, if we don't tap down on this, if we don't hold people accountable, you know, this thing holds, like I said, started in 2015. In 2018, we got a waiver to challenge their maps. And we've gone through hell to get to where we are. And now to go backwards and then showing after we were, and the maps now being, by testing, being done state by state, showing that we can have more accurate maps and make sure that we pinpoint the areas that are basically best left behind. So, like you said, if we don't get it done now, if it's not done now, whenever it will be.
Before we started talking today, I was thinking about the similarities between Maine and West Virginia. Each of them has one or two fairly large cities. We have Portland, Bangor. You have Charleston, Wheeling, a few others. And then you have this looming big city. In your case, it's North Pittsburgh. And in our case, it's South, it's Boston. But most of our state is rural, small towns, long distances, just like they couldn't get electricity in the 30s. And now we're making that connection, which is why I think this is maybe one of the most important things either you or I have done in a long time.
But Angus, I guarantee you that. And, you know, let me make sure I'm more accurate on what size of my state, but a little over 1,750,000 people. I don't have one town. I don't have one city bigger than 50,000. 49.5 is my biggest city.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I'm a state of towns. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought Charleston would be bigger than that.
Now, Charleston's 49.5, 49.6, okay? But now, if you look at all the little outlying areas that incorporated themselves, if you try to put all of that together in that one region of Kanawha Valley, that's about 200,000.
Okay.
The town itself, okay? So we use the geographics of that to help us with the type of population that we have to use that. But other than that, Northern Panhandle is right close to Pittsburgh. The growth area we have, the most growth area, is right in the North Central, Morgantown, where the university, that's our fastest growing county now.
Well, listen, Joe, congratulations on your work on this. I know you've been at it at the very beginning with the committee when you first started on the maps. And I don't know about you, but I've been telling people about this experience. In the first article that I wrote when I was first running for the Senate in 2012 was about rural electrification and the need for broadband. I quoted Lincoln and Roosevelt. But then I got here and we worked on it. Nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, the American Rescue Plan and the bipartisan infrastructure bill come along, and we were able to get it done. And I think it's what I tell people is, this is a tough place to do business. It's a tough place to get things done. But if you stick at it, every now and then the stars align and you're able to get it, make it work.
Well, Angus, one thing about it, the facts will prove that whatever the federal government may think, they don't intend not to give us the service. They just basically took someone else's word for it. Wasn't happening. So the only thing that we have said is, we're going to show you. We showed citizens, Angus, even today, please, they're telling me you're covered in this area here. Do the testing. We showed them how to self-test on their telephone, on their wireless telephone. Self-test wherever you live. Tell us what your speeds are. Boom, boom, boom. And we had maybe 20,000-30,000 people that self-tested, because they said, hell, I'm not getting coverage. And they're telling me I am. Well, I'll prove it to you. So once we did that, we're able. And also, if you have some people in the Maine that says, Angus, I know you're working hard. I know you've done everything you possibly can. But if someone told you they got me service, I don't have service. And you can prove it to them if they do the self-testing. So we'll share that with you. So you can share with all your citizens.
That's where we are right now. We're in the middle of the build out, and I'm getting very good reports, but I plan to test it and to see how it's going, because, as you say, you have to be careful. And I think the final thing I wanted to touch on, and I mentioned this a little bit, is affordability. We got to be sure that there's a service provided that people can afford, because it doesn't do any good if they have the wire but they can't pay for it.
Well, and that's really where the co-ops come into in rural areas, because they don't have the profits, where they have to make a profit margin to meet the shareholders' demands. And they've been so much better at giving quality service for affordable prices. So I'm a big supporter of co-ops.
And then you get some competition in the picture, and that helps.
That fires up the T-Mobiles and the AT&Ts and the Frontiers of the world, I can tell you.
Nothing like it. Well, Joe, thank you. And I want you to plan on coming to Maine next summer.
I am coming, buddy. I want to be there so bad. I've been there a couple of times, but the beauty is just unbelievable.
Well, and I've been to West Virginia, as you know.
Yeah.
We were at Shepherdstown not long ago.
That's right.
And it's also a beautiful place. So
well, we coined the almost heaven, and you've been trying to tell me, but you really are heaven. But I'm going to still get you at least let you coin the almost heaven.
There you go. All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you around here, and we'll visit each other's states.
I'll tell you, we've got great people, and they're hardworking people. They deserve to have the connectivity to be able to compete anywhere in the world and connect with their family and friends. That's all we're after.
That's a great way to close. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you, my friend. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks for staying with us on Inside Maine. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Andrew Butcher and my friend Joe Manchin. Broadband is a big deal, and it's coming to a road driveway near you. And I want you to be in touch with my office if you're having problems, if you don't think it's working out in your area. Like Joe said, we got to be sure we're testing and making sure that this money's being well spent and that it's having the impact that it's intended to have. So great to have you on Inside Maine. We'll see you next time. This is Angus King. Have a great day.